Maybe nobody in a medical office really says the doctor will see you now anymore, but the phrase is certainly imprinted in the national consciousness because most of us have spent time in waiting rooms, killing time until that moment when the medical provider has time for us. Today's guest is a medical provider, and he is adamant that people should not wait. In fact, he flips the entire medical transaction around in his book, The Patient Will See You Now. It's a look at the various ways in which technology, including our smartphones, can profoundly change the doctor-patient relationship. Dr. Eric Topol is a cardiologist and a professor of genomics and the director of the Scripps Translational Science Institute in La Jolla. His previous book is The Creative Destruction of Medicine. Dr. Topol, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
I have to ask first, are there some MDs who don't talk to you anymore?
No, they're talking, but some of them, of course, are not pleased about the prospects of losing control and having this big shift representing the biggest challenge, really, in the history of the medical profession.
I'm curious about translational science. What goes on at the Scripps Institute?
Well, we do a lot of things to innovate the future of medicine, and that includes genomics, like sequencing human beings, and particularly healthy ones, aged healthy ones. And we do a lot of digital medicine things where we explore all these things that the smartphone can do to change the future of medicine.
I guess that the answer is sort of the next question, is how you get to question your profession itself. But it sounds like when you're out on the leading edge of things, you probably turn around and look back once in a while and go, why are we still doing that?
That's exactly right. You know, we're going to really laugh about how medicine was practiced not so long from now, because we didn't have the tools until now to be able to get this high-definition, granular information about each person. And that changes everything, particularly when a lot of that data is being generated by the patient himself or herself through their own mobile device.
Well, in a nutshell, is this book about making medicine more like Amazon, in a sense? I mean, more stuff at your fingertips, more things available online, rather than having to go to a doctor's office?
Not quite. No, really what this is about is that we have these ways to gather information that we never had before, like a real-time continuous streaming of your blood pressure, your heart rhythm, your glucose, all the different metrics that define our what makes us tick. We also, of course, have the way to change a smartphone into the physical exam to do many of the parts of the physical exam. And we have virtually any lab test, diagnosing any infection through a smartphone. So what we're talking about is getting this powerful diagnostic and monitoring functions that through devices that we carry around with us all the time. And therefore, that part of medicine is shifted, democratized to each individual if they want to adopt that. And then the doctor's role is very different. It's more of a partnership with guidance and wisdom and experience that can be transmitted. And that is a real division of efforts. And as it turns out, when individuals have their data, they're much more motivated, they're much more engaged, and they go to a healthier plane.
Democratized in the sense that that really everybody can get their hands on the technology, as opposed to having to go to somebody special. Just like as with phonographs, you know, you could have to play music at home and not have to go to a concert hall. In this case, you don't have to go to the doctor.
Well, this is more like the printing press, really. When you go back in the 1400s, that was what was disseminated information to the common person. And up until now, the medical community has controlled all the data and all the things that were ordered, and you had to beg to get your data. And by the way, it was your body and you paid for it, and you can't even get your own information. Well, that's going to be very different going forward.
It seems like a lot of MDs might welcome the kinds of changes you talk about, because then they would have patients who had done at least some homework themselves before they got to them and wouldn't have to get involved in a bunch of cases potentially. Yeah.
Well, I think you're right that more physicians that are experiencing this whole concept of patients taking charge and having their data, generating it, and also in the context of their life, which, you know, we as doctors don't have that. We see people as a one-off visit, not as with a, you know, knowing what's going on in their real world. So by having that data, it's a really for those who are willing to see this and really adopt it, it's quite telling, because people really get into it, and they I think are going to find, doctors in general, that this can decompress their workload, and it will help so many individuals be much more actively involved with their own care.
I want to separate, Dr. Topol, the present from the future, because the first example you give is of a person getting a rash diagnosed. Are there smartphone apps for that now?
Oh, gosh, yes. There is a smartphone app for any skin lesion or rash, for a child with an ear infection to have your heart rhythm, electrocardiogram, obtained through your fingertips, through your phone. Get your eyes refracted through your phone. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. They're all available now.
Okay, you mentioned that a patient emailed you in an electrocardiogram a while ago and said they were an atrial fib. How long ago was that, and what did you do?
Oh, that was over 2 years ago. Basically now, it's not just that you can get the cardiogram through your fingertips. There's also algorithms, software, embedded in the app, which reads the cardiogram, which, by the way, we've had in hospitals and clinics for 3 decades, but now any individual can have this in their phone. So that person who I was worried about having a heart rhythm, like a lot of my patients as a cardiologist, he had gotten the app and put his fingers on and got the reading, and then he just sent me the tracing with the reading and says, I'm an atrial fib. Now what do I do? And when you get that kind of email, you start to realize, that's interesting, because that patient previously would have had to go to an emergency room or to an urgent clinic appointment because they were in this serious heart rhythm abnormality. And now the person's made their own diagnosis, and I'm treating that remotely through exchange via email. So that is just an example of how there's this dramatic shift going on.
A lot more to talk about changes in medicine present and future with Dr. Eric Topol. His book is The Patient Will See You Now. The future of medicine is in your hands, and that's meant quite literally with all the smartphone technology. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Topol, and you can join the discussion as well, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. We'll resume the discussion and include you as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. The Patient Will See You Now is the book by Dr. Eric Topol. He's a cardiologist and professor of genomics and director of the Scripps Institute in La Jolla. He's written a previous book called The Creative Destruction of Medicine. He continues along that path with The Patient Will See You Now. We could talk about all the changes coming to medicine, changes many of which have happened already and more to come. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with you, you can join us at 800-838-3760 anywhere in our listening area, 800-838-3760, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. So, Dr. Topol, the example you just gave of the patient who emailed you their ECG and said, hey, I'm in atrial fibrillation, so they'd already diagnosed it. Do you have any concerns, though, about people misdiagnosing things or getting panicky because of something that they see in a smartphone app?
Well, I have even more concerns of the fact that there's over 12 million serious errors. Many of them are life-threatening in the United States per year with our current way that we practice medicine. And I have concerns that the fourth leading cause of death in the United States are medication errors. So we can do a lot better. And there's these things called computers, that process information that can be very helpful, and especially if you have such a powerful one in your pocket or your purse. So this is a shift that's inevitable, because no human being can process the amount of information we're talking about when people have these, various sensors, their DNA sequence, this granular information, the likes of which that was unimaginable just a few years ago, for each individual.
So I know that even before smartphones, when sites like WebMD came up, a lot of people were starting to show up at doctor's office saying, there could be this, it could be this, could be this. I mean, you've probably been through that yourself in private consultations. Did you welcome that sort of thing? Did it catch you a little off stride at first?
Yeah, I think that this is something that is not I went to medical school in the late 70s, and we weren't ready for this stuff. Back then, you know, the term digital was only referring to the rectal exam. You know, things have really changed. This is such an exciting, yet obviously a highly challenging time, because it really is directly taking on the autonomy of physicians. In many ways, it also challenges the whole reimbursement patterns in the United States. So this isn't an easy one to make this transition.
All right. You got right to one of the nubs here then. I was going to ask about money, and it sounds like there is a concern here that that if people are diagnosing themselves and going straight to the stuff they need rather than going to the doctor's office, there's a concern that doctors will make less money.
Yes. This is a real challenge, because these things, like we talked about, dermatologists, pediatricians, optometrists, cardiologist. I mean, there isn't a type of doctor that isn't going to be challenged because of the way diagnoses and monitoring will be made. But as long as doctors are still very much engaged in the treatment side, and that, of course, comes with communication and empathy, and a lot of things we're talking about are just the routine matters, you know, the special circumstances are still going to require the same face-to-face visits and help with diagnosis. But if that shift can be made, and that doesn't compromise how physicians, make their livelihood and ideally more salaried rather than fee-for-service, of course, then everything should be okay.
You raise a number of individual case histories here, including Kim Goodsell, who had a very rare set of medical conditions. Can you walk us through her story?
She's pretty incredible. She's a patient of mine who first had a collapse with sudden death, was resuscitated, had a defibrillator put in, and she was told she had this very rare heart disorder called arrhythmogenic right ventricular dysplasia. And then years later, she couldn't hold a utensil, she couldn't walk, and then she went to Mayo Clinic, and she was diagnosed with Charcot-Marie tooth type 2. So we're talking about two incredibly rare diseases. And I wrote in the book, the chances of having these two diseases is less than being hit by an asteroid. So, you know, this is this woman who had no medical background. She says to the doctors at Mayo Clinic, how could I get these two rare diseases? And can't there be something that brings it together? And the doctors, both the neurologist, the cardiologist, said, Mrs. Goodsell, you just have really bad luck. So she spent the next 2 years of her life researching herself and getting into genomics and the pathways. And, you know, this is all really hardcore autodidactic stuff here. And she basically found the root cause of her two disorders, which was a unifying mutation in a single gene. She goes back to Mayo Clinic. She says, I want this gene sequence to see if that's what the cause of all this stuff is. And indeed, that's what it was. And so it also led to her being better, because she had come up with a diagnosis that then led to some successful treatment. So it's an amazing story, but it's a sign of the times. And there's many different individuals who take us to this current way of practicing medicine. I mean, Angelina Jolie is, of course, a central character in the book as well.
And talk about that, the Angelina effect.
Well, she, because of not only pushing to get her own molecular diagnosis of risk for breast cancer, and then having not just the bilateral breast removal, she's also going to have her ovaries removed in the future, but telling the world all about it, a person of that massive public profile, teaching everyone about, you know, you can get your genetic story and find out if you have risk and do something about it. And it's really powerful, because as she titled her famous op-ed, My Choice, that's what's out there. Everyone has a choice to get information that they didn't have before.
The diagnostic stuff is really good, but I've noticed cases, for example, there was a piece in The New Yorker several months ago about parents who just couldn't figure out what was wrong with some of their kids, and they ended up finding, as Kim Goodsell did, very, very rare conditions afflicting their kids. So they've at least got to the point of understanding what's going on here, but often are there treatments just not available for that because the disease is so rare and because, for example, the pharmacological industry really hasn't felt like they needed to pay attention to that?
Yes. So that's actually in the book as well, and you're talking about the really excellent New Yorker piece by Seth Nukin, One of a Kind. Yeah, the Matt Wilsey family and their daughter Grace, that story is told in the book, and that is, there are so many people, and this is one of the things we do at Scripps as well, where there's an unknown diagnosis, and there's someone who's suffering, and it's often a child, but it could also be adults too. And they have these big workups. They go from one medical center to another, and it's called a diagnostic odyssey. And oftentimes we're talking about, you know, $1 million plus of expenditures and no diagnosis using conventional technology. But now with sequencing, and in the family that you mentioned, there's sequence of the little girl as well as the parents, you can find out the molecular diagnosis. And that, as you're pointing out, that doesn't always lead to treatments right away. But in the case of Grace Wilsey, there are some headway being made now that the diagnosis and the biology is understood. But sometimes, as we've experienced, you can actually repurpose a drug that wasn't intended for that mutation, and you can come up with very impressive results. So just having the diagnosis is a big plus, and you're going to see a lot more of this. That is that fancy term we use in medicine, idiopathic. Why don't we just say we don't know? But, you know, that's going to become extinct over the many years ahead.
I've often joked about the use of the term contraindication. It's the only profession that uses that term.
Right. Yeah, we use a lot of fancy words, and that's going to go because this whole field is going to get democratized.
We're talking about the field of medicine with an MD, Eric Topol. He's the author of The Patient Will See You Now. The future of medicine is in your hands. You can join this discussion on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Anne and Eugene. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Eric Topol.
Thank you. My observation is just because people have knowledge doesn't necessarily mean they change their behavior. For instance, I'm sure that bathroom scales have been around for at least 100 years, and yet 70% of the people, the adults in the United States, are either overweight or obese. And there's all kinds of knowledge out there about the problems that this causes people, both structurally, cardiovascularly, all these things. And yet, they have this knowledge. They're either overweight or obese. They do nothing about it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Anne, for that, which raises, you know, that's a great question. In fact, one of the last I had on my list was, you know, what in this constellation of shiny stars makes us eat better or exercise more?
Well, firstly, you know, a lot of the things that I'm addressing are medical conditions, not obesity, but things like, you know, seizures and asthma and heart attacks and autoimmune diseases. So those are not necessarily tied into lifestyle. They're just, you know, what people can get during the course of their lifetime and have better ways to either prevent or treat. But now let's get into lifestyle issues. Such as obesity and sedentary behavior tobacco, alcohol, all these sorts of things. Well, it turns out there are a lot of strategies that can be smartphone-based with social networking and our digital infrastructure, which have yet to be tried in a very scaled way. And that is, for example, setting up managed competition, co-opetition, among peers, families, networks of people for the best lifestyle, whether that's losing weight and sustaining the weight loss or more exercise and activity, all the above. But also there can be financial or other incentives that are built in by employers or groups. There can also be gamification. That is, making it more fun to take better care of yourself and lifestyle. So these are all digital things that can be added on because the average person looks at their smartphone between 100 and 150 times per day. And if they're getting constant feedback and incentivized and making it fun and competing, which, by the way, really gets the juices flowing, those are things that we can leverage to promote a healthier lifestyle.
Interesting. So if part of the reason for people being sedentary is them going to their smartphones and playing games, turn the games into something that'll motivate them to do something else.
Right.
Potentially.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's just limitless opportunities here to explore, at least. Behavior is the hardest thing, as the caller aptly points out. You know, just having a scale isn't going to make people lose weight. But, you know, that is not the primary issue here. You know, we're going through the Fitbit and fuel bands and all these other, you know, activity trackers, you know, these wireless step trackers. And that isn't really medical. That's lifestyle. And what we're talking about today really is a switch to the medical front.
All right, let's take another call. Here is Mark in Reading. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Eric Topol. His book is The Patient Will See You Now.
Yes, good morning. How might this apply to poor and working class people as opposed to the middle class to wealthy people you seem to be talking about?
In other words, the people who can't afford smartphones?
Yeah. I'm not talking about the wealthy and the middle class. I'm talking about democratizing medicine because, as you can envision, this is taking Moore's Law to medicine. That is, the amount of money it costs to put chips in. There's more than 2 billion transistors in a current smartphone. And smartphones out of China cost $35 that are similar to the ones that cost $700 in this country. Now, it's a lot cheaper to give a person who's indigent, homeless, to give them a smartphone and a service contract than it is to be treating them for a day in the hospital costs in this country $4,300. So we're not talking about a digital divide here or affluenza. We're talking about a strategy which would be economical, using cheap smartphones that have all the bells and whistles of the ones that are commonly used in this country, and giving people internet connectivity, because that's a whole lot cheaper than the way medicine is practiced in this country today.
Here's another call from Gail in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I'm a breast cancer survivor, and I don't have a smartphone, but I do have a computer. And in my research, I found a study where a tea made from a plant that grows around the globe kills breast cancer cells in vitro. And I gave this information to OSU. I got plant seeds from a research university in Pakistan. OSU has successfully grown the plant. The Linus Pauling Institute has committed to studying it, and I'm thrilled because I want another option other than cut, burn, and poison in breast cancer treatment. Pakistani and Indian women use a tea from this plant with which to treat their breast cancer. And I've gotten great help from around the globe just on the computer.
All right. That's a fascinating story. Thanks so much for sharing that, Gail. Appreciate that. So, Eric, there's a whole world out there that people are taking to themselves to research.
That's right. Citizen science is on the move because one can access not only your own information like never before, but obviously we've got the open capabilities through internet to get into all sorts of other information, which will get progressively better.
You write in the book about Hippocrates. You take us way back in time, the father of medicine, but you also call him the father of paternal medicine. How did he earn that tag?
Well, you know, I didn't know about a lot of stuff until I researched it. And I, of course, only had heard all the good things about Hippocrates. But as it turns out, he was the master of concealment. He said that doctors should conceal everything from patients, because by giving them the information about themselves, like the prognosis, that could harm their psychological well-being. And that has been carried on. That was 400 BC. That carries on today. That although we tell people if they have cancer, which, by the way, you know, as I wrote about, my grandparents both died from cancer. The doctor never even used the word. That was in the 60s. But that we've made a little progress. But still today, 70% of doctors don't believe patients should have copies of their office notes about their bodies that they paid for. They shouldn't have access because they think that it will get them upset and anxious, whereas studies have definitively shown that that's not the case at all. So we don't have enough respect for patients, and that unfortunately comes from way, way back, more than two millennia ago.
So you write in the book as well about a fairly public disagreement with the AMA over patient access to data. I mean, do you see any harm in a patient having info, even if it's potentially frightening stuff?
Well, let's put it this way. We've done studies. You know, we published in New England Journal a large study of thousands of people where we gave them back their risk, genetic risk for Alzheimer's. Some of them had, you know, tenfold risk. And not just our study, but others have documented that people handle that kind of data extremely well. But obviously, this everything we're talking about here this morning is not for everyone. It's about if you want your information. But as it turns out, the people who want it really do well, and they thrive. And why shouldn't they have the right? It's an entitlement. And not only should they have the right to access, they should be owning their data. And they should be saying to the doctor, I'll share it with you. And by the way, I won't even charge you for it, and I won't fax it to you. I'll send it to you by email. You know, so we got a long ways to go to make this power shift, which is going to happen because information is portable, and it's going, most of it now, will be going directly to patients.
Much more to talk about with Dr. Eric Topol. He is the author of The Patient Will See You Now. The future of medicine is in your hands. A world of change is potentially looming, and a lot of it taking place already with the use of smartphones and diagnostic apps. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Eric Topol and more of your phone calls and emails in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about medicine in this hour of the Jefferson Exchange, particularly where medicine is going with new diagnostic tools, including ones the doctor does not possess. You do, as apps on your smartphone. Dr. Eric Topol, who is a cardiologist and professor of genomics and the director of the Scripps Institute in La Jolla, wrote his book called The Patient Will See You Now about just this sort of thing, where the patients have much greater control over their medical fates and fortunes. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, 800-838-3760, or by email jx@jeffnet.org. We already talked about Angelina Jolie and her very public decision to have her breasts removed now and ovaries later to prevent the possibility of getting cancer because she has the genes that indicate those things could happen to her. In that chapter about the Angelina effect, we begin to get some idea of the FDA's responses to changes in medicine. How has the FDA rolled with all that's been going on?
Well, it's been mixed. In some ways, they've been very progressive, such as approving the electrocardiogram app and sensors and digitized pills where you put a chip in a pill to track adherence. Certain things they've been, and now recently the approval of glucose to be shown directly on your phone or watch rather than having to have a separate receiver for diabetics who track their glucose every 5 minutes. But regarding genomics, it's been concerning because it's so inconsistent. You've got these trucks driving around, who's your daddy, doing paternity checks in the street where the FDA has no oversight, no regulation, and then you have a really important effort as the one that 23andMe put forth to get people, particularly their drug DNA interactions is the thing I was impressed about, and they shut them down essentially. It needs to be consistent, and I'm hoping it will also be supportive of this movement.
Another call here from Ray in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Eric Topol.
Thank you. Good morning. My kind of comment and question for the doctor is, I understand what he's saying about the smartphone issue, but one of the things that I've seen with the advent of the Internet and people doing their own research and kind of trying to take control of their own destiny when it comes to illnesses and things like that is that it seems like people type in their symptoms on the Internet to start research, and it never fails. Everybody I've ever talked to that has done this, it seems like they're scared to death that they have cancer or ALS or some other horrible disease. By the time they get to their doctor a month later for their appointment, they've worried and fretted for a month, and then you go to the doctor and it's just some minor thing. It seems like the majority of people who do this get themselves all worked up over nothing for the most part when they're going to see their doctor anyway. And I wonder what his comment was on this, whether it's going to take a lot of education for people to realize that, you know, who they can trust and the information they get.
Right. I'm glad you bring that up because you're basically talking about the past here. You're no longer looking on the internet about which, as you point out, people got any diagnosis and if anything they looked up. We're talking about people having their own data about you, and you're getting all this streaming of information about your body to your device, and you're not looking up on the internet about some completely something that's irrelevant, not necessarily pertinent. So it's a whole different look when it's your data rather than other people's population data that is very difficult to have grounding or interpret.
So what's the first step in obtaining your own data?
Have the tools to get it. So it depends on the condition. I mean, a lot of my patients have high blood pressure. So not only today can you have apps that you get your blood pressure without any cable, through a wristband, but in the future there's a watch that will get your blood pressure every heartbeat while you're not even pressing start during your sleep, traffic, stress. But that's the sort of thing. 70 million people have high blood pressure, and they haven't had data, particularly continuous data like that. So it just depends on the condition that you are concerned about or trying to manage better. And that's not looking things up on the internet. That's looking at your data in the context of your life.
And some examples you give of ways in which things can be checked. Elizabeth Holmes and her company, Theranos, was surprising. I mean, we're talking about instead of the tubes of blood, one drop, and she can get the same analysis in minutes?
Yes, but her whole effort getting it in drugstores is going to be quickly superseded by your ability to do this on your phone with a droplet of blood, like a finger stick. And then you go ahead and take that droplet, because now we have microfluidics that can measure hundreds of things through your smartphone that include liver tests, thyroid tests, kidney tests, your blood counts, your electrolytes, chemistries, all through your phone.
Well, and this is what you're talking about as LOC, or lab on chip, but then you move on to talk about LIB. What is that?
The lab in the body, and that is... that's further off. So everything we've talked about has already been shown to be feasible. A lot of it's already commercially available. But then in the future, there's the whole concept of embedded nanosensors in the bloodstream. And that's when you can have your blood under continuous surveillance. So if you are at risk for an autoimmune disease, or you have a risk of cancer, that is, you've already been treated and you want to have constant monitoring, risk of heart attack or stroke, you can have your blood under surveillance, the kinds of things you can't do with a wearable Band-Aid or a wristband or that sort of thing. So that's something in the future. These little sensors can talk to your smartphone and give you warnings when something's not right. And we have hundreds of these types of sensors in our cars, but we don't yet have these sensors in our bodies. Someday we will.
Well, let me jump ahead then. If we could monitor from inside the blood potentially, can we repair from in there too?
Well, there's a lot of talk about that. These nanoparticles that can be also sensors can be potentially directed to treatment. So that's even further off, I think, although there's many recent papers about that concept. So you're right. Linking in a closed loop, sensing and treating, is a potential in the future.
I have to believe there will be some security concerns there, A, about the diagnostic part, where the person sitting next to you in the cafe can figure out what's in your blood, if you're pregnant, et cetera, and then potentially change what's going on in treatment when we get to that point, if we get to that point, when we get to that point.
Well, I emphasize in the book there's a whole chapter about secure versus cure, and the point being, as you're acknowledging, this privacy security issue is really critical to address. It hasn't been addressed at all yet. And right now, it's not like a Google search or an Amazon purchase where that data of yours is being brokered and sold. We can't have that for medical data. And there has to be laws against that. And not only that, but if you own the data, and if you want to sell it, okay, fine. But that's a whole different look. And we have done nothing yet to assure privacy and security of medical data. Plus, we have the hacking that goes on just a little over a week ago with 80 million people with Anthem. unencrypted data. It's amazing. So this has got to get fixed.
Well, we've been hearing about the electronic medical records or electronic health records for years. Are they anywhere close to universal yet? I mean, could you potentially within a year or two, or can you already call your doctor's office and say, just email this to me here?
Well, it depends on the health system. There are a few, very rare, that will have any access, you know, wherever there's a mobile signal, you can get all your information. But that's quite unusual. The problem we have is all the different health systems around the country use different systems, and they're not compatible. And so most people actually go to many different doctors, oftentimes even crossing health systems, and this is a real mess. It's just the Tower of Babel. And that is, again, the reason why each person has to have their data, ideally someday in something like their own personal cloud, so they can override this problem. Because the United States has done nothing to make sure that there's a common a platform across all different electronic medical records. Basically, the companies that have been involved have their own proprietary means, and so nothing is done to shore this up.
Couple more calls here. Let's go to Jacob in Springfield. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Eric Topol. His book is The Patient Will See You Now.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to just point out the problem with all this data is the same problem that we already have with the Internet. We have information, but there's a huge potential for misinformation. A lot of doctors, you know, minutes with patients are trying to dissuade patients from these phony ideas that they get. Like, for instance, if you look up vaccines, you know, there's a lot of data on the Internet that goes against, you know, the wisdom of vaccines, you know, and people grab onto that, and it's very hard to disabuse them from those concepts once they get it. But I want to point out that information is not knowledge, and knowledge is not wisdom, and wisdom is not making the right decision that the patient needs to make at that time. And with primary care physicians, up to half of their visits relate to mental illness, you know, depression, behavioral problems, mood disorders. And a lot of the times, patients with psychiatric illnesses, they have no insight into their condition, and of course, they make bad decisions, you know, and so they're totally unreliable narrators or observers on their own condition. And you're asking these 50% of people that they should be able to judge their own lifestyle and make the correct decisions on their health and their behavior and their mental health. Hmm. And I don't see that happening. I think a lot of the times the doctor has to be there to sort out, you know, what's important, what can kill you, what's an acute disease like meningitis. And then there's a lot of other diseases that are just managed that are never cured.
Okay, let's get a response.
A lot of it has to do
with psychology. I agree with some of the things you're saying, like the horrendous outgrowth of vaccine misinformation, but I totally disagree with you about our approach to mental health. So first of all, there's grossly insufficient people, that is doctors, counselors, to deal with the number one cause of disability in this country, which is mental health problems, and particularly depression. And it turns out that you can quantify now depression using these sensors for the first time.
Really?
Yes, you can get through voice and through communication and activity and your vital signs like blood pressure and heart rate variability, galvanic skin response, your facial recognition. All these things can now quantify your state of mind and can help to understand, because a lot of almost all was subjective. Now it's quantified objective. And not only that, but we have all sorts of new studies that have shown that that there's ability to help people with depression through texting, through virtual medical care and support and counseling. So this is going to be a big movement, and it's going to address something that has been left in by the wayside. And this is a serious problem in this country, where there's a mismatch of qualified personnel, healthcare personnel, to deal with the number one cause of disability.
Why? I mean, is it just because it takes that much longer to go to school to learn how to be a psychiatrist, or what are you supposed
no,
to do?
No, it's just that the numbers we're talking about of Americans who are affected overwhelm what we have in the medical system. So it isn't about education. It's just a total mismatch. And it's a worldwide problem, but it's especially large in the United States.
We had one caller wonder if stuff like this is available for your pets. And I'm talking about the diagnostic stuff on smartphones, for example.
Well, the first electrocardiogram smartphone was actually approved for veterinary purposes before humans. So, not too much for pets specifically, but almost everything we've discussed today, of course, could be adopted. I don't know that we're going to be talking about depressed pets, but certainly pets with heart or lung or other issues, infections, a lot of those things eventually will come to pets.
We've just brushed lightly on the whole cost part of the equation in terms of primary care physicians being concerned that their incomes might go down. Is there the potential here to make this cost less to the healthcare consumer?
Absolutely, because in every other walk of life, we've seen how chips make things cheap, except in medicine. And so this is a great opportunity to leverage Moore's Law, which hasn't been done before.
Why is medicine so resistant to that, then?
Well, it's a lot of reasons, but the biggest ones are loss of control. So this autonomy that's been around for well over 3,000 years. But in addition, the gaps in education that we've touched on, and also the change in revenue, the real hit that is already happening with the Affordable Care Act and all these things that we've been talking about could make it worse.
Well, you're right at the edifice complex. And given changes in healthcare, why are we still building hospitals at the same rate?
That's a really good question. We do need hospitals for operating rooms, for intensive care units, for emergency rooms, sophisticated imaging. But the rest of the hospital, that is the regular hospital room, eventually will be gutted, because all that could be done in the patient's home.
So much to think about. The book is called The Patient Will See You Now. The Future of Medicine is in Your Hands. Dr. Eric Topol wrote it and probably got a lot of the other doctors angry with him for doing so. Eric, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You bet.
Go
Take care.
Now.